now senior lecturer in the Business Department of the University of Sydney. His research area is in memory, cognitive information, and cognitive foundations, and he's one of the very active people in the collaboration. His talk today is going to be on reference frames and relationalism in quantum theory.
All right, thanks, Owen, and thanks, everyone, for giving me the chance to talk today. So I'm a quantum information theorist, but I do enjoy thinking about some foundational issues and working with some people who definitely call themselves quantum foundations researchers. And this work is a bit of a collaboration in that area that's been really fruitful. One area that I think really bridges the boundary between interesting questions in quantum information theory and interesting questions in foundations. That's why this collaboration with my colleagues here has been particularly useful here. When working on issues in reference frames, I think I'm working on quantum information theory. Rob Speckens thinks he's working on quantum foundations. Terry Rudolph thinks he's just goofing off and having fun. And I think basically all of that's true for all of us. So let me start off with basically the philosophy that we're taking when looking at the role of reference frames in describing quantum states. So a very common view is that quantum states describe intrinsic properties of a system. So people talk, for example, about the quantum state of an electron, saying that that's some intrinsic property of the electron. What we'd like to argue here is that quantum states can describe intrinsic properties, but they can also describe some extrinsic properties, that is, properties that relate the system to something external to it. Specifically, we'll be thinking about reference frames. And there are some systems where they have no internal properties, intrinsic properties, all of the properties that the wave function describes are extrinsic in this sense. So we've explored many different approaches and ideas along these lines, and this review article that I've quoted here summarizes a lot of them. What I'm going to discuss today is some recent work that's yet unpublished, so you won't find it in this review article. But I'm going to start off just by trying to illustrate what I mean with these common ideas before getting into this new research. Okay, so here's the standard example that we use. Thinking of a quantum spin half particle, what does it mean when we say that the spin is up along the z-axis? If we say a spin half particle is in a plus a half eigenstate of jz, well, of course, we mean that it's relative to some reference frame, relative to another physical system. We're describing its orientation relative to something else. So it could be gyroscopes in the lab, whatever, something that's defining a Cartesian frame. And when we talk about the quantum state of a spin half particle, we're not talking about any intrinsic properties of that particle at all. We're really only describing its relation with that reference frame. And so that's at the heart of what I meant on that last slide. Okay, so given that we're describing something relative to a reference frame, there are many ways that we can treat that reference frame within our theory. And a very standard way is to treat these reference frames as external, and basically not talk about them at all. So when we talk about a spin half particle, the Hilbert space is defined with some implicit reference frame in the background that defines what we mean by up, but we don't really talk about it at all. We're not treating that reference frame as a physical dynamical system. And so we describe quantum states in this particular setup as just properties of the system. And it's only implicit that it's described relative to some external non-dynamical reference frame that we're not discussing. Of course, we have another option. We could talk about having a quantum object itself a dynamical thing with a, that we can assign states to that describes our reference frame. And so that's what I mean in this picture here. This is the reference frame, and here's the system. And I can have some state on the, that describes the two of these. And of course, it's possible for me to describe the state of the two of these with respect to, again, some external reference frame. And when we write down the standard, standard way you might denote a state of a system and together with the state of a reference frame, maybe we'd use some angular momentum eigenstates as a basis for this, and maybe also some angular momentum eigenstates for a basis of that. Again, we're saying implicitly there's a background reference frame, R prime, that's classical and non-dynamical that we're describing things relative to. So I'm going to refer to this as the internal, the external paradigm, and this one as the internal paradigm, where we have now treated the reference frame as internal to the system, but keeping in mind that when defining the Hilbert space for these things, we still have an external one in mind. Okay, and then within this internal paradigm, if we said, well, what is just the reduced density operator of this state on this system, when just looking at the spin half particle, well, now we're giving it a state that's described relative to this R prime, and that could be quite different than this one up here, described relative to R, if R prime and R are not related. So these two states need not be the same in this case. Okay, so let me be a bit more specific about how we might describe the state in this internal paradigm. Well, the simplest thing we could do is assign a quantum state to this system relative to this external frame, and a quantum state of our reference frame R relative to this external frame. And I'm going to denote that by this pure state E. Of course, it could be mixed, but just for simplicity, I'm going to consider it to be pure. What happens if, I should make one comment on this. So this is imagining that our object that we're treating as a dynamical system serving as a reference frame R is correlated precisely with this background frame R prime. So I'm putting in a system, and I'm going to say it's oriented in a certain way. When I describe that quantum state E, I'm describing that orientation relative to some external frame. I'm saying the x-axis is going this way, and the y-axis is going that way. Z-axis is up relative to however I've defined my Hilbert space. Of course, it could be different. I could have this external frame different from this external frame. They could be related by some rotation. And how would I describe the system in that paradigm? Well, I would use rotation operators. Here's an action of the rotation group on the reference frame R, an action of the rotation group on the system S. And so describing now this internal system plus reference frame as a quantum state relative to a slightly rotated background frame, I would use that notation. And here's the main point I want to get at, is that now what if these things were all I wanted to talk about? I wanted to talk about just those things without any reference to how they're correlated with some background frame. Well, then I would just mix over all the possibilities of how this internal system can be related to this external frame. So what I've done is I've described different rotations of this internal system relative to the background frame and averaged over all of them using some invariant measure there that reflects my lack of knowledge. That's just a normalization constant out front meant to describe the size of the reference frame system. So just to simplify notation, because I'm going to use that mixing operator a lot, when I write G as a super operator on some quantum state of the reference frame and system, I mean this rotation of the reference frame and the system by the same angle omega mixed over all possible angles using this invariant measure. So when I describe a system and reference frame in this way, uncorrelated with any background frame, then the state of this system in reference frame has some very particular properties. It is going to be rotationally invariant with respect to any background frame I pick because it's completely uncorrelated. And in particular, thinking about angular momentum, that means there's going to be no coherence between different eigenstates of the total angular momentum. So it's like we've enforced some sort of superselection rule in this particular problem. OK, so here's the central question that I'm going to try to address in this talk today, is I want to try to relate these two paradigms, this internal one where I'm describing the reference frame as a dynamical quantum object, and I want to try to relate it with this external picture where I'm saying I want to treat the system just with respect to some background frame and see how they relate. Now, obviously, that's going to depend on how I choose the state of the system that's serving as my quantum reference frame. So one of the central questions is, what are the properties that I would need of a dynamical system R serving as a reference frame in order for it to be good at that job, in order for me to have a system that's very similar, isomorphic to this external paradigm. And we're going to find a condition such that that we can describe this internal system with this good reference frame through this external one by showing that they really are exact. And then we can ask even additional questions. Well, what if it's good but not perfect? Can we still find some way of relating these two pictures? And I will show that we can. In fact, that we can find how to characterize specifically the bounded size reference frame effects if it's not perfect as a reference frame. The key result here will be that if this reference frame is of bounded size, it is not serving as an ideal classical background reference frame, but is in somehow limited, that we can still relate it with an external picture, but that we get some sort of effective decoherence going on. Now, this has been observed by many people, especially in the context of reference frames for time, that is clocks, and of course this is precisely what Jared was talking about in the earlier talk today. So all of these papers focus specifically on the idea of reference frames for time, clocks, and pick specific examples of what is going to be the state of the reference frame which serves as a good clock, maybe bounded in size some way. Our goal here is really try to generalize these ideas to a most general reference frame, whether it's a clock, whether it's some sort of spatial orientation or something else, and also to look at just how general we can have the states of that quantum reference frame be and what effects that will induce on our description when we try to externalize it. So that's really the point of the talk today. Now I'm going to get into some of the details of that. But if you come away with just one thing from this talk today, is that this idea of an effective decoherence that you get from using bounded size reference frames, that can be made very precise, and we can quantify the level of that effective decoherence in a very general way. That's the point of today's talk. Okay. So going back to this picture, I said we're going to describe a system with respect to a reference frame in one of two possible ways. One is this external one, where we just talk about the state of the system relative to some idealized background frame. The other is where we've internalized the reference frame. Now we're describing the reference frame and system together with respect to some uncorrelated background. And I want to know how these two descriptions compare. So what I'm going to do is look at how we can do measurements on these two things and reproduce the statistics of quantum mechanics, i.e. reproduce the Born rule. So I'm thinking of doing a measurement on this system in this paradigm, and that measurement is described by these measurement operators, EK. I'm going to try to think of an equivalent measurement over here, EK tilde, on a system and reference frame together, and I'm going to ask, how can I construct a measurement that attempts to do the same thing in both these pictures? And by comparing the statistics of these two measurements, I'm able to say something about how good this state is at approximating this state and vice versa, how well they compare. So over here in this state, we have just the system relative to this background frame. We talk about measurement operators just on that system. And the Born rule, I calculate probabilities for a given outcome k just by taking this trace. Over here, we have rotationally invariant operators on, rotationally invariant state on the system and reference frame. Any measurements we do, we can do measurements relative to this background frame, but it makes no difference because this background frame is uncorrelated, whether these operators depend explicitly on that background frame. So we might as well just do rotationally invariant operations on these two things. And the outcomes, the probabilities for a specific outcome k, will be given now by this trace over now the system and reference frame. So can we construct a measurement scheme such that these are equal? Or if not, how close can we get? OK, here's a method how we can try to mimic some measurement on this system over in this paradigm. So we don't know how our background frame is oriented relative to this internalized frame. So what we could do is just try to, first off, measure that orientation. Let's perform a measurement described by a covariant POVM on this reference frame system relative to our background and try to see how it's oriented. And once we have a guess as to how it's oriented, we obtain an outcome omega, which describes the measurement outcome relating the orientation of this and that. We can now say, OK, well, we'll now measure this system using this measurement operator, but in a rotated basis, describing that. Now I'm going to measure the system relative to this external reference frame, and I know how it's related to this internal one. And of course, it doesn't really matter what is the orientation of this external one. So we can, in a sense, all our measurement operators can just be an average over those different results of measure this relative to the external one, then this relative to that outcome against the external one. But it doesn't matter what that external one is. So we mix over all possibilities. So this is the measurement operators described in that case. It's a bit of a mess to try to show that that is, in fact, the best you can do. All measurement operators can be sort of cast in this form. And it takes, again, using a simplifying notation, the state of the reference frame, and then here's our measurement operators just on the system, and then mix them using this G operator. That's how we get those. OK, so now we're comparing this measurement on just the system to this measurement on this combined system and reference frame. And how do we do? Well, there's the words what the Born rule produces in each case. And here is the proof. It's only a few lines, so we'll go through it in detail on how the probabilities of an outcome k, how they relate on here to these original states and operators. So we have an expression for what is the state of the system and the reference frame mixed over all angles. Here's those measurement operators, again, mixed over all angles. So we just express out those two g terms and get a double integral. And now we're going to do a bit of arranging now into operators on the reference frame, which I'm going to put on this side. And you can see that now it just comes out to expectation values of rotations within this reference frame state E. And over here, we have operators on just the system. And then a couple lines of rearranging, you can see that we have within this trace over the system, we have what looks like a mixture of the state of the system row rotated by different possible angles, but now not rotated uniformly, weighted according to this distribution here. So we can just lump all of this together, this expression that says take our density operator and start mixing it over possible rotations weighted according to this distribution function and call that a form of decoherence. It's a decoherence map D acting on this state rho. And the outcome just becomes that decoherence map on rho together with EK trace over the system. So I've shown here, this is for a completely arbitrary reference frame state that these operators measured on this system leads to a calculation for the probabilities in the Born rule that looks like of this form when written in terms of that state rho and those original measurement operators we're trying to mimic. And this decoherence map that appears in this expression is just looking at an average over possible rotations weighted according to this distribution, not uniform anymore. So if we had, we can ask how in a sense, peaked can we make this distribution? Can we make it such that only the identity rotation is included, in which case this wouldn't be a decoherence map at all. It would just give back the state rho. If we have a reference frame of unbounded size, then we can satisfy that condition. We can choose a state of a reference frame on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space such that this thing essentially becomes a delta function in omega, and we can make that decoherence map just the identity map. However, if we're fixed to some bounded size reference frame, we can't do that. This decoherence must be there if we have any finite dimensional system, and we're talking about a continuous group here. We can never make that a delta function. Okay, so we're trying to compare this and that. We want to make them equal. That's not going to be possible if we have a bounded reference frame, but we can show that they can take the same form if we consider there to be some decoherence on this state rho. So what we've just proved here is that if you have a reference frame of bounded size, then this leads to a form of effective decoherence when you're just doing the simplest task of trying to reproduce the statistics of the Born rule when measuring operators on this system and reference frame combined. Okay, so let's take a moment and think about if we have a bounded size reference frame, what is a good state for that reference frame. So let's imagine constructing our reference frame out of a whole bunch of spin half particles, but a finite number, some large but finite number n. So you might think, well, let's just point all of those spins in one direction. That makes a good reference frame for that direction, but not a very good reference frame for orientation around that direction, because that state would be invariant about rotations about that axis. So we really want something that looks more like a frame. So we might take a bunch of those spins and point them in one direction, a bunch of those spins and point them in another direction, and a bunch in the third orthogonal direction. But that, it turns out, is not the best we can do. And let me just try to quickly outline the general construction we have for saying, given that you have a bounded size reference frame, what is the optimal state we can use to make that effective decoherence the smallest? Okay, so I'm going to just very quickly breeze over some simple angular momentum addition rules. You know, if you have two spin half particles, they can couple together to a total angular momentum of 0 or 1. If we have four spin half particles, we can couple them together, the first two to 0 or 1 and the last two to 0 or 1, and then look at how those can couple together, and we can get a whole bunch of different possibilities of how they can couple together to spin 2, to spin 1, or to spin 0. And we get multiple copies of how they couple to spin 0 and to spin 1. Only one copy of how they couple to spin 2. And of course, this generalizes to higher and higher spins. In general, when we want to write the state, of many qubits in terms of its overall angular momentum properties. We can label them by J, M, angular momentum eigenstates, but we have to use an additional label, alpha, to label these multiplicities that can appear. So I'm going to suggest that we can use this type of state to define a new tensor product structure as follows. Just define it arbitrarily through this form. And when we couple many spins together, the Hilbert space will generally take the form of a whole bunch of possible angular momentums ranging from J equals 0 up to N on 2. I'm assuming an even number of spins here. Some angular momentum space describing its angular momentum properties, and some multiplicity space, which basically is just labeling my alpha. Okay. So this space is spanned by those angular momentum states. This space is spanned by these alpha states. And I think, just in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the interpretation of that and go basically right to the result we're going to use. Okay, so that's the form of my Hilbert space. And I can look at the relative sizes of these rotation spaces and these multiplicity spaces. These rotation spaces, of course, all have dimension 2j plus 1. These multiplicity spaces can get very large with n. And so here's just an example for n equals 20. Here's the dimensions of the rotation spaces for given values of j, always 2j plus 1. The dimensions of the multiplicity spaces can be enormous, except for the very top one, which is always just 1. So here's the general construction we have for this particular group, the rotation group, on how to construct an optimal state. And the proof that this is optimal is quite complicated, but the general form is sort of illuminating. We create maximally entangled states between the representation space and the multiplicity space whenever we have the case that the multiplicity space is bigger than the representation space. We have 2j plus 1 here. We just have to find 2j plus 1 vectors within this huge space and create maximally entangled states. Now, that doesn't work at the very top because we only have one state over here. But for all these others, you can find as many states over here as you need to pair up with ones over there and create a maximally entangled state. You weight things across these irreps in a somewhat natural way. And this general form of the state turns out to be optimal for minimizing that effective decoherence. And this particular form of the state generalizes very easy to arbitrary groups. So here's the result that we had earlier. We had this decoherence map, which was a weighting of possible rotations by according to this, this weighting here. And when our state takes this particular form, that this particular form up here, that weighting looks like a delta function, and it becomes more and more like a delta function as we have larger numbers of spins. Now, this is important that it's a delta function in terms of all angles, no matter what n is, no matter what rotation we're using, it looks like a delta function. So if we just had a bunch of spins pointing up, sure, it looks a bit pointy when we rotate it this way and this way, but when we rotate it about this axis, it doesn't look like a delta function at all. With this particular state, no matter what angle we rotate it around, it's very, very highly peaked. And so we can use that result to minimize the effective decoherence. So am I running out of time? A couple minutes. Okay. So we can work out explicitly for this rotational case what is the effective decoherence you get as a function of the number of spins you used in your reference frame, provided you put those spins in this particular form. And the result is that the decoherence map looks like a mixture of no decoherence and total decoherence. This G twirling, of course, is mixing over all possible rotations and completely mixes the single qubit state. And as the number of spins we include in there grows large, JR grows larger and larger, this term begins to dominate, and this term disappears. But we can quantify this exactly for this particular group and also apply these results to more general groups. Okay. So key here is that as this reference term becomes larger and larger, we really do approach this, this isomorphism, reproducing the Born rule exactly. For any finite size, then we're going to get an effective decoherence, which we can explicitly quantify. Okay, there was a big discussion about where in the Hilbert space we can find this qubit when we talk about the system and reference frame together. And it's a bit of a Where's Waldo game, and I'm going to skip that. I'm happy to discuss those details about specifically where this qubit lives when it's somehow in the invariant state of the system and reference frame. I mentioned that this type of thing can be applied to different groups. In particular, you can apply it to a phase reference. I don't even really need to go through this example because this is the one that Jared described. Here I'm considering it in terms of a phase eigenstate with fixed total photon number. You could apply the same calculation to a coherent state and see what results you get. There's the result for a phase eigenstate. Okay, so that just brings me to my conclusions. Quantum states describe extrinsic as well as intrinsic properties. When we're talking about a spin half particle, or any spin particle, there are really only extrinsic properties that the quantum state is describing. Equivalently, you could say relational rather than absolute degrees of freedom. There's different paradigms in which you can describe a quantum state, one where the reference frame is external, one where it's internal and treated as a dynamical quantum system. And you could ask, how do those two compare? If the reference frame is of infinite size when we're treating it internally, then you can have an isomorphism between the two. When it's not, when it's bounded in size, you get an effective decoherence, and we can calculate that quite explicitly. All right, thanks for your attention.
Thank you.